Hi everyone, welcome to Chinese Whispers. This is where we demystify the People's Republic of China. We are Amal.
And Jyotsna.
We are foreign policy enthusiasts interested in understanding China.
Today we'll be talking about Xi Jinping, the Communist Party of China's General Secretary, China's President for Life, and according to the Forbes magazine, the most powerful human being on the planet. He is so strong that he is afraid of a cuddly bear with no underpants. Oh, Winnie the Pooh.
Well, yeah, that makes Winnie the Pooh the most powerful non-person on the planet.
That's right. Yes.
Yep. So, Jyotsna, why are we talking about Xi Jinping?
So, he is the most powerful person on the planet and he is the leader of China. And China increasingly is shaping the way the global order is affecting the way the world is run. So, we get to see how this person runs the country.
So, you mean to say that Xi Jinping is absolutely relevant for us to understand China in the next, like, up until he's alive, I guess.
Not just China, but absolutely crucial to understanding how the world order will be shaped in the coming few years.
Yeah, so much power in one man's hand.
Yes.
But anyway, so to our listeners, in this episode, we are going to talk about Xi Jinping's background. Then some of his major initiatives, and then we will try to sort of hash out why he does what he does. That is the structural factors behind it. And as you might be aware that in this podcast, we don't look at people for their own emotional decisions, but we look at what are the structural factors behind any decision-making process.
That's
so,
right.
Over to you.
Yes. So as oxymoronic that might sound, Xi Jinping was born almost as a communist princeling in Beijing. He was a son of one of the PRC's earliest generations of leaders, but his family soon fell out of favor after his dad was purged for supporting a book which was critical of Mao's policies. And from then on, the princeling was sent to live and work in the impoverished countryside of the Shaanxi province, where he was supposed to be re-educated by revolutionary farmers and workers. This hardship and constant indoctrination apparently turned him redder than red. That's what people who have known him say. Or perhaps it was just that was the one way of surviving in that sort of situation where there was no other way but to pledge your allegiance to the party.
Mm-hmm. So, what's red here?
Red as in communist.
Like super communist.
Yeah, super Maoist.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, in fact.
Make a note of that.
Yes. He attempted to join the Communist Youth League after getting rejected 7 times. He was trying to fit in and do what was cool at the time. Yeah, and some people in the party say that he went to Tsinghua and studied chemical engineering, but there are doubts about that. It is said that he went to Tsinghua, but he probably did not study chemical engineering. He went there just for the tag and to network with the who's who of the party and work his way up. Some accounts suggest that he was just a worker, peasant soldier who didn't actually study, but was just busy doing party propaganda at university.
Mm-hmm. So that means that he was just like all of us, sitting and doing nothing in college.
Yeah, right? Just like I went to Oxford for the tag, just like that. Yeah.
Exactly. See, Xi Jinping is very normal, just like all of us.
Yeah, but I don't see myself becoming Xi Jinping any day.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like I said, he started networking within the party and advanced his political career through several county, municipal, provincial leadership positions across the country. But despite all this, he was never popular among the Communist Party elite. Perhaps because he was very low-key and also because he had a controversial family history. But things really started changing for him when he was picked up to lead the party in Shanghai. And next thing you know, he starts building the support network around him and things become very clear that Xi Jinping is the next big thing when he is picked as Hu Jintao's vice president in 2008. Perhaps his history, the history of his dad, and his coming out of the closet as a hardened revolutionary, or at least putting the pretense of it, and his projection of this image of being a people's man who's lived in caves, lived a hard life. Maybe all this worked for him.
Or did it? We never know.
Let's
look at further details. Right. So let's look at one specific instance of his term, which is probably his landmark campaign apart from the Belt and Road Initiative. This is called the Anti-Corruption Campaign, which a lot of people in China, at least back in the first half of the 2010 decade, used to love it that he's actually taking on corruption, etc. So the conventional idea we have is that, oh, bureaucrats and politicians are taking money which they are not supposed to take for doing their work, and therefore they are quote-unquote corrupt and eating up the system. That's the typical observation we have going from, let's say, the pre-1991 era when corruption was high, and then when more cleaner governance has come in, we see that corruption has gone down. However, in China, that's a little different, or rather very different. So to start with, in the early Mao era, or actually in the entire Mao era, there was nothing called corruption. Their only corruption was ideological corruption. That was because they only looked for loyalty to Mao Zedong and to his ideas and his thought process, etc. When Deng Xiaoping came in, he said, okay, loyalty doesn't matter, but what matters is that you make your own money and let the economy grow. And your own growth is highly dependent on how much the economy functions. This was a way of promoting economic activity for at every level. The same thing was done, or rather the opposite thing is being done by Xi Jinping. Pretty much the same thing as Mao. That only loyalty matters, nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's look at how he frames this particular anti-corruption campaign. So he says that he wants to take down the tigers and the flies. Now, the flies are the ones who are the low-level people who are very, very corrupt, as some people might call them, but they are the ones for whom he wants to destroy the financial incentive. Now, the tigers are actually his political opponents. They are people from different factions who pose a political challenge to him. And he's just trying to take them down one upon the other. And he's placing his own loyalists at every possible instance, sort of building the entire CCP and by extension all of China around him. In fact, this entire campaign has become so bad that political prisons in Beijing are now overcrowded. And in fact, during the recent coronavirus story, Xi Jinping has actually been using that as an excuse to remove different party chiefs and then place his own loyalists in those places. Yep.
Mm.
And if all of them get coronavirus in the prison, well, he's probably a happy guy. But why, let's see what is his top priority?
Like, yeah, I don't think he would mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think he would mind overcrowding of prisons during coronavirus outbreak at all.
He probably wishes all of them dead.
Yes. Yeah. Unlikely allies, the virus and Xi Jinping.
Well, it also is a threat for him, but we'll discuss that in a certain episode. So,
yes.
So that's why the ultimate point of this anti-corruption campaign is to reinforce control and to make sure that his rules over everything else, that loyalty to him is the only way for you to survive in China. And it also sort of makes for good PR in China, that reinforces his people's leader image.
And there's a theory for all that to top it all up, and to sort of institutionalize this personality cult around Xi Jinping into Chinese social and political life. And that is called the Xi Jinping thought. So imagine Modi's Mann Ki Baat, which you not only have to listen to, but you also have to stick close to your heart. You have to get diplomas in it at your school or university. There are actual Xi Jinping thought centers in universities. You even have to memorize that thought proposed by your leader to impress your date.
That's the best thing.
Yeah, imagine.
There was that video from, I think, Zhejiang province where a couple is like two people on a date are testing each other's knowledge on the Xi Jinping thought.
Yeah, that would be equivalent of, you know, matrimonial ads in India where they say, oh, my son or my daughter can listens to Mann Ki Baat regularly.
I look forward to seeing that actually someday.
Yeah, that would be fun. So Xi Jinping thought is actually enshrined in the constitution. It was introduced during the 19th National Congress, which was in 2017. So in China, in PRC, every political era has had its own guiding philosophy proposed by the leader or the party chief at that time. So there was the Mao Zedong thought, there was the Deng Xiaoping theory, then Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao didn't really have their own names attached to the theories. It was the three represents and then the scientific outlook on development theories, respectively. So only Mao and Deng had their names attached to the theories, and then Xi did. So that put Xi up there in the League of Leaders. But only Mao and then Xi have been presidents for life.
Yes. So I have a question here. Why is it that in China we have so many of those grand thoughts, like Mao Zedong thought and whatever stuff you described right now? Why don't we have like Indira Gandhi thought or Narendra Modi thought and stuff, or even Barack Obama thought or, you know, George Bush thought? Why don't we have that? That's a fundamental question.
Why don't we have the Donald Trump thought? It's the best thought in the world, beautiful thought, exactly. Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a genuine question, right? That why is it this way? I mean, my hunch is that because it's still an empire. Like, an empire portrays the leader as some great grand visionary and stuff. Like, you know, with the mandate from heaven and etc.
Yeah. Yeah, you know how much hurt and upset it caused the people of India when India was equated with Indira. Indira is India. India is Indira. So that just doesn't work in democracies. You can't have a guiding philosophy that encompasses all aspects of life and one that is proposed by the leader of a country. So, for example, in foreign policy, we have the Indira Doctrine, or you have the Gujral Doctrine, and now we have the Modi Doctrine. But that doesn't mean that if I have to, say, make friends at school, I have to bear in mind what the Modi Doctrine is. I don't care. You know, that's just how... Yeah.
Yeah.
This is something else. It goes beyond your political life and beyond how countries do foreign policy. So let's discuss that further. So what comprises of the Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics? So socialism with Chinese characteristics is a way of saying that, oh, this is a government of the people. But then, you know, let's interpret it according to the way that keeps the party at the helm of all things. We get to call all the shots, and there is no other way. And that room for interpretation allows for excuses for everything. So, you know, someone might come and question China. Oh, you guys don't have democracy. And China might say, oh, well, this is democracy, you know, with Chinese characteristics. Or someone might say, yeah, you guys don't follow international laws. They might say, oh, yeah, we do follow international laws. We just interpret them
with
Chinese characteristics. Or, look, you guys can't just be throwing people in internment camps. Oh, no, these are not internment camps. These are internment camps with Chinese characteristics where people go to get vocational training.
No, so training camps with Chinese characteristics.
Yeah.
Let's fix that.
Yeah. There's always some way, you know, to reinterpret it and make it sound nice.
Yep.
So party leadership covers all aspects of life. And what else gets covered in this Xi Jinping thought? There's focus on law and order, excessive focus on law and order. Then there's this talk about one country, two systems, covering Hong Kong, even Taiwan. Then focus on national security, and that the military is under the control of the party. Then a focus on party discipline, as you explained, which is not really about the efficiency, but more about just consolidating power and control. Then there is some talk about deepening reform. And when I say that, I'm not talking about liberal values, obviously, but this is about, again, reform to reinforce discipline and complete order within the system.
Yeah, Jyotsna, let me plant a flag there, actually.
Hmm.
That because we know reform as, oh, liberalizing more, like,
yeah,
like promoting more private property, yeah, promoting more economic rights, etc. For them, reform, they might say that that's what they're doing, but what they actually do is the exact opposite.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, clamping down on everything, yeah, left, right, and center.
Yeah, we assume reform means something to do with opening up, but China doesn't. Yeah. This is reform with Chinese characteristics, you know.
So, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Then Xi Jinping thought also covers scientific development, tech advancement. Sounds great, but no, it is not. When you talk about scientific development and tech advancement and your dictatorship, you're essentially building a surveillance state and you're monitoring all activities of your citizens and you're going to punish them for the activities you don't like. You're going to build a system where, you know, you might punish them for, say, you might make their gas expensive if they criticize you on the internet, for example. Or you might make it impossible for them to buy train tickets if they say 1989 or look up 1989 on your version of Google. Yeah.
Yeah, 4th of June.
Which is the Tiananmen Square massacre.
Massacre. Yeah.
Yeah. There's also some focus on China's relationship, or at least communist China's relationship with the world in the Xi Jinping thought, and how Xi Jinping wants that relationship to be maintained. And he says that China will build for the world a community with a shared future, which essentially translates into the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative. When you look up BRI on YouTube, you see cute kids playing guitar. There's animated dams and ports and roads that talk about joint prosperity, sharing goodness. There's even a Belt and Road rap in there. You know, all this, yeah, looks good. Easy loans, yeah, infrastructure development, no questions asked, invest in useless values like human rights. Sounds, yes, like a good deal, but it, yes, is not.
Shared good, yeah, sharing goodness with Chinese characteristics.
Yeah.
You don't know where that will go.
No. It might work well for, you know, shoddy, corrupt elite in the third world, especially authoritarian third world, there, where China is essentially building client states out of white elephant infrastructure project deals that only serve China's strategic interests, be it security and leverage over countries that China sees as strategic competitors, like Japan, India, US, Australia, countries in Southeast Asia. It could be maintaining presence in strategic locations, which are crucial to supply of oil and mineral resources to China, and maintaining unfettered economic prosperity through control over global commons, which could be trade routes. So it's not just a bunch of infrastructure projects. It's a mega foreign policy project that seeks to inject a lot of cash into countries and then essentially ensuring that they help push Xi Jinping's China dream forward and build him as this demigod who finally brought China out of the world and out of years of century of humiliation and crowned it as the great power it was always destined to be, with access to or control over resources and markets worldwide, and with all its enemies under check.
Awesome. Let's just again plant another flag that destined to be a great power, quote unquote, with Chinese characteristics.
Yes.
Because, you know, that could, yeah, mean many things. But, yeah, it sort of, you know, gives us an idea that Xi Jinping is basically the emperor, the great Raja Bhoj, who's out there to sort of give his benevolence to everybody. And we all know how that ends. So that's why let's look at how, like, why Xi Jinping is doing all this. Like, is it because he wants to do it? Like, is it really a thing that one person's wishes and desires or wills can, you know, change the behavior of 1.5 billion people? I doubt that. I think there are many structural factors which are sort of dictating the situation, and he's acting mm-hmm. based on those structural factors. In other words, it's not because he wants to do it, but because he has to do it. So our hypothesis, which is partly true, but like there's some evidence of that, or rather a good amount of it, but not conclusive yet, is that China is actually in a very fractured situation. Like different authors have talked about this. And Xi Jinping is just trying to keep them together by clamping down on all of them put together. So let's talk about this specific style of, you know, the difference that happens in China. And this is actually a very cyclical thing. It has happened in history a lot. Like over and over, China goes through 30, 40 year cycles of different types of administration. It is defined by either being a closed system or an open system. By open system, you mean that they'll be free trading allowed. There'll be private property. Merchants will be allowed to trade privately, etc. A closed system puts a ban on merchants, puts a ban on pretty much all types of private property, doesn't allow you to make money by yourself so that you don't gain much power by making that money, etc. So for example, and each time there's an open system, the stresses become so strong that China breaks apart in a way. And when, so that's why at the end of that 30, 40 year cycle, somebody has to, the emperor has to clamp down. So for example, from 1911 to 1949, China was actually open. The coast was trading with the world. The rest of the country was not really trading with the world. So that's why there was a major difference in the economic opportunities to the coast and the interior. And that's why they did not really like each other in a way. And that's why the openness was so much that the country actually disintegrated, because there was no strong central power. This was only unified once again in 1949 when Mao clamped down on the country and forced an iron-fisted totalitarian rule. That's what led to the foundation of the People's Republic of China. Now, CCP did exactly what you might expect. They eliminated private property, closed off ports, banned private trading, and obviously the economy took a nosedive. Now, at the end of this cycle, what happens is there's a financial crisis because all of this sort of closes, locks down on the economy. And this sort of also coincided with Mao's death. And this was in 1976. So in 1978, when Deng Xiaoping took up power, he flipped the coin, or rather flipped the switch, sorry. And he said, let's promote private property, quasi-private property, let's trade with the world, etc. And one of his famous quotes is, it doesn't matter if the cat is white or black, as long as it catches mice. And you might expect that people remember that, hey, the coast was rich at one point of time and the interior was not. So if the same thing will happen, then the coast will get rich again and the interior will not. So his answer to them was, oh, if everybody's get to be great, someone has to get rich first. That was the promise he gave in 1978. And I think he repeated that a couple of times, I think also in the South Tour in 1992. And with this process, he pushed 80% of the country's budget onto the coastal areas, depriving the inner parts. And that led to a huge economic boom, largely in the coasts. And that made China the world's biggest exporter. Now, this has obviously created huge divisions, as you might expect. And Xi Jinping is just trying to clamp down on them. Exactly how Mao did. Yes, you heard that right. He's doing exactly what Mao has done. And he's on his way to become a full totalitarian dictator, if he has not become already. And once again, maybe not because he wants to, but because he has to. And now that there's the other side of the cycle which he's dealing with. And this sort of started in 2008, when the financial crisis actually hit, the global financial crisis. Back then, Deng Xiaoping had said, hide your strengths, bide your time, don't do much nationalism, don't do much chest thumping, etc. But starting in 2009 or so, CCP started pushing nationalism, and it gave a famous lie that China was not affected by the financial crisis as compared to those so-called inferior Western democracies, and hence it was much more superior. So you can see that this sort of a cycle is happening, and Xi Jinping is doing exactly what Mao had done, or rather very close to what he had done. He's trying to incorporate more types of social controls, etc. And that's why he's and as I explained earlier, that during Deng's time, there was private financial incentive, aka corruption, that is being replaced with loyalty, just like during Mao's time, hence the anti-corruption campaign. when the 2008 crisis hit, the CCP leaders understood that grease of private financial incentive would disappear, and they needed something else to get the country and the party together. And the only thing was nationalism, well, because, you know, communism was dead. And that's why when Xi Jinping was rising to power around that time, he was not actually the most acceptable candidate amongst all different competing factions. He was the least unacceptable candidate because he was pretty much a nobody back then. It's like it was a matter of surprise that he was raised to power at that point of time. And that's why when he took power, he started threatening the Jiang Zemin faction, that is the Shanghai group. He started taking steps to centralize China, make everything state-owned, state-controlled, you know, going against private property, and also took down a bunch of people. Like Zhou Yongkang was his greatest victim of his anti-corruption campaign from the other faction.
Yeah, so Xi Jinping is very close to being the emperor that rules China.
Yep, unless, he probably already is.
Yeah, unless coronavirus gets in the way.
That's true.
Yeah, so that's all for today, guys. More on Xi Jinping rule China and how he's been carrying out his foreign policy with a specific focus on Hong Kong in our next episode. Do send us your feedback and comments. We'll link our Twitter below in the description. Also, feel free to send us questions that you'd like to see addressed. If you like this podcast, do share the link and subscribe to our channel. So until next time, see you and thank you.